This is the fourth lecture in nature. And in the cycle of our learning, this is the end of the first month. And so every fourth lecture, I try to come back and recapture for us the sense of the form that by now has developed enough that we can begin to recognize that there is a gestalt, a serviceable gestalt, which we have for ourselves, and we can take now enough language to begin forming it descriptively rather than delivering it prescriptively. A prescriptive language is instructional, but a descriptive language is educational. The first form that we can now recognize is that nature is essentially characterized by cycles. There are cycles, and thus the word ecology describes the process of nature quite accurately. What that ecology is very difficult to say without making some kind of ecology which does not have steps that freeze dry the action. In other words, to have a cycle which does not have gear teeth on it so that it has to jump like a gear tooth circle would jump, but rather that it flows. One of the best philosophers of the early 20th century, Henri Bergson, talked about creative evolution, and that creative evolution has, instead of time elements like seconds or minutes or hours that would be ratchet teeth on a gear that jump, that creative evolution has a duration. It has a flow. And that this flow is creative in the sense that its onwardness is a continuity which not so much gains strength, but gains resonance by continuing to occur. You don't speed up, you don't intensify, but the ongoingness of the continuity creates by resonance. And it's rather like the Japanese technique of calling koi in a pond. You simply take one finger and dip it into the water, and by a slight rhythmic movement, you send out a consistent rippling. The koi respond to the consistent rippling because this to them, in their fish body senses, is an indication of communication for food. And they will come to you. So that the cycles of nature can be characterized in a Zen way by calling koi in a pond, or philosophically by the resonances of an ongoing creative evolution, a duration instead of a time, and the duration's continuity ensures that the resonances all have the same shape as the original form. Sometimes in Eastern and Western wisdom alike, the metaphor that's used is that of a bell. When you ring a bell, the sound waves from the bell will have the same shape as the bell. If the bell is cone-shaped, the sound waves will be resonances of that cone. If it is classically bell-shaped, the resonances will be bell-shaped. If it's rather spherical, the resonances will be spherical. Nature is characterized by a cycle of interpenetrating resonances. And the totality of this pattern has phases through which it goes, And these phases, rather than being geographical, spatial delimitations, are phases of maturation. The best source of the phases of maturation of natural cycles in print occurs in the Tao Te Ching, this 2,500-year-old Chinese wisdom book. And in the division of the Tao Te Ching, chapter 42 has the most forthright presentation of the five-phase energy cycle, which characterizes the ecology of natural resonance. In my translation of Lao Tzu, this is how it reads. Always at the beginning of a chapter from the Tao Te Ching, there are two characters, a pair of Chinese characters. The pair here, the first character is Tao, and the second character means transformations. So Tao Transformations, chapter 42, and it reads in the following way. Tao produces unity. Unity produces duality. Duality produces Trinity. Trinity produces the 10,000 things. The 10,000 things bear yin to embrace yang. So chapter 42 begins with this five-phase energy cycle. In the first phase, Tao occurs before existence has a form. When Tao becomes dynamic, that is to say, in its movement, it achieves objectivity. Notice the paradox that the worldly ego considers objectivity staticness, whereas just the opposite is the case in nature. Nature occurs objectively when it is dynamic. When nature moves, it is objective. And when it stops moving, its objectivity tends to disappear. The ego, in its formulation of a world, is an inverted nature. It's a nature upside down and backwards. And so very often, one would refer in wisdom traditions to the ego world as a mirrored existence. It is backwards. And if the mirror were like the eye, it would be upside down. For instance, if you look into another human being's eye at yourself reflected in their pupil, you are upside down and backwards. The American sage Black Elk wrote, "It is in the dark of men's eyes that they become lost." It's this quality of continuity, this quality of resonance, which characterizes nature. Its dynamicness is where objectivity occurs. And thus, Tao, when it is dynamic, is objective, and the Chinese designation for that is Te. So the title of Lao Tzu's book, Tao Te Ching. Ching simply means book. The book of Tao Te. Now, Tao Te, when put together, when said together, when those two characters are put together, Tao Te, one has a very powerful interface. One has the interface of mysterious Tao and existence in its primal unity, its objective wholeness, brought together. It would be like our saying 0-1, that somehow 0-1 together characterize a very powerful symbolic view into the nature of nature. All one needs to do to make it a symbol is to convert the juxtaposition of Tao Te into a ratio by putting a line, a denominator line, between the top and the bottom, between the two elements. That is to say, as soon as you make a ratio out of 0, 1, the ratio 1 over 0, the ratio of 0 over 1, though they remain in both cases the same, 1 over 0 is still 1, and 0 over 1 is still 0. But the form in which one is able to write this now, the ratioed form, is able to operate on levels that were not existent before. What level has come into play? What level is in existence now? With a ratio, the level that now occurs, now has objective existence, is the level of symbols. And the symbolic level is the level of mind. So that the mind has an objectivity. The mind is like nature. It's paradoxical vis-a-vis the ego. The ego believes that nature is statically objective, and that when it is dynamic, that it becomes so ambivalent as to be gestalts that are not able to be determined. It holds the same view of the mind, that the mind is so watery, so evanescent, so infinite, that it cannot possibly be objective. In both cases, at the same time, the ego's view is turned inside out and upside down. In an odd way, the ego is a contrapositive of the real. That is to say, whenever an objectivity is presented, the objectivity that you are addressing with your cognition is only one quarter of what is totally there. For whatever form you are cognizing, there is always a reverse to that form, there's always an inverse to that form, and there's always a contrapositive to that form, which is the reverse of the inverse. This logical quaternary can be shown by a hand, the back of the hand, put down, the back of the hand reversed, which is the hand upside down. This quality of fourness reoccurs east and west always when thought refines itself to discursive structure fine enough to penetrate through to real objectivity. It is called, for instance, in Western philosophy, the fourfold root of sufficient reason. And it is one of the great fundamentals, for instance, of Western mathematical thought. It occurs first in Leibniz and is developed philosophically in people like Schopenhauer, and comes into play in Western mathematical thought from the 1870s on to our own day. Nature has an objectivity when it is dynamic. When the dynamic of nature calms and achieves not stasis but equanimity, the objectiveness that has occurred because of dynamic disappears. It disappears by absorption. It would be just the same is when you take a bell and you ring the bell and the sound waves reverberate out and the reverberation is in the shape of the bell, the sound waves, their resonance. If you could somehow freeze dry the progression of the sound waves going out, the bell-shaped sound wave resonances, and reverse them so that they collapse back in, they would disappear back into the bell. Equanimity in nature has this absorptive quality. And in fact, in physics, we understand that all matter has a resonance noticeable primordially in the form of radiation, and that the radiation can be absorbed, that matter absorbs radiation, and that matter also emits radiation. So the emission and absorption of energy is characteristic of matter, and energy is a resonance of matter, which is matter put into dynamic. When matter is brought to its quietus, to its equilibrium, the resonances reabsorb back into the material, and the material no longer then has an objectivity which is distinct in terms of existence, of separateness, but only an objectivity distinct in terms of unity. A great example of this, 1996 physics. If you take hydrogen, molecular hydrogen, and you cool molecular hydrogen to absolute zero, just before you reach absolute zero, several billionths of a degree before you reach it, molecular hydrogen instantly transforms, and instead of the individual molecules having a resonance, all the molecules, all the atoms, which are the same in molecular hydrogen, atomic and molecular hydrogen are the same at that, in that element, all of the individual atoms cease to act individually and they act as a single atom. So that in the mystery of objectivity, of the material of this universe, the objectivity occurs in the dynamic, and the resonance of the material is due to an energy emission or absorption. Both processes are going on at the same time. So that one can characterize nature now quite accurately. One needs two terms which work together. And we use the Greek terms because the Greek terms were the first that were used in terms of math and physics. Out of all the languages of the world, we use the term dynamic and energy because the Greek dynamis and energeia were first used characteristically and intelligently to distinguish two kinds of force which always work together. Energy is an emission and absorption, therefore a resonance. Dynamis is the carrier substrate of the form which allows for emission and for absorption to continue in the same form on the same level. The resonant echoes of the bell's shape are carried dynamically. The resonances themselves are energy. So that nature can be said now to be an energized dynamic which has an ecology of flow. And as long as that flow is occurring in an ecologically sound way, nature has both tau and te together. It has both a zero base and a unity, a oneness. And because it's zero and it's one, are balanced completely and perfectly, it is here that a third expression comes into play, which is not another thing, but is the recognition that zero and one work together, so that one has a mystery on one's hands. The first stage is a zero base designation. The second is one. And the third is that zero and one together are a togetherness. The ego cannot and refuses to understand this. The ego will always portion out and say zero does not exist. One begins with one, but two means two ones, and three means three ones. This is a classic problem in spiritual development. And so one of the most esoteric texts that one can find, let's choose a text from the East, is a text from roughly the 3rd century of the Common Era, 3rd century AD, in China. And its translated title would be Balancing the Three Ones. That is to say, a technique of meditation to take these three ones and instead of arranging them in a linear fashion, of arranging them like a Y coming to a single point, showing that the three ones are not three separate ones, but come together in a single focus. This was a therapeutic meditational technique of about 1700 years ago, meant to cure the ignorance of misperception and a further rebound. Misperception always entails then a flawed conception. If you misperceive, the conception, which is based upon perception, will be flawed. So misperception cues in a faulty conception. What is the cure for this? That by having a resonance purity reestablished, all the resonances together form what is called a consonance. And the consonance will always be the harmonic of the resonances. Now, this is true whether it's in music or in mathematics or in art. Its truth holds all the way through all the levels of form. So that we have a very particular quality of nature, which we can now say. The Chinese basic ancient saying, which characterized nature, which includes us, is that man is the bridge between heaven and earth. The modern way to say this is that man ratios heaven and earth. That heaven and earth come together in a ratio because of our participation as an interface between them. And that our interface between them is of a very particular and paradoxical nature. We are not a static line between two things. We are the area of exchange between two forms of the same thing. So that man is characterized as an exchange interface between zero and one. Or to use the I Ching terminology, that when Tao Te come together, they are proportioned by human-heartedness. And the word, the Chinese word for human-heartedness is Jen. So that Jen proportions heaven and earth together. And instead of then saying tau te, because they are proportioned by man, one refers to tau te as heaven, earth, tian ti. And tian ti, in translation, literally means multiplicity. It means the world of the 10,000 things. Whenever Lao Tzu wishes to talk about the world in general, he will say tian ti, or the 10,000 things. You use that phrase. In our Western way of using language, we would say that heaven and earth meet at a horizon, and that man's equanimity, as his fundamental nature, is the horizon where heaven and earth meet together. And the ancient way in the Western tradition, is characterized initially by a civilization that had three different prongs at the very same time. It had an Egyptian prong, it had an Iranian prong, and it had an India prong. So that ancient India, ancient Iran, and ancient Egypt were three prongs of the same family of tradition. In that triple prong of the most ancient Western wisdom tradition, the word for our reality was always a word that described the horizon which both vanishes and reappears. And because the horizon which vanishes or reappears as a horizontal line was so difficult to conceive, later on when your perception is combed pure, one can conceive of a whole horizon vanishing and reappearing. But because this was so difficult at first, the sun and the moon and the stars, as vehicles which penetrated the horizon of the earth, rising above it into the heavens, settling below it into the earth, the sun and the moon penetrate that horizon each day. The stars, in their rising and setting, penetrate that horizon. And so the movement of heaven and its concomitant patterning of the earth was seen to be mediated by this horizon and symbolized by the bodies, the sun and the moon especially, which in their movements sewed together heaven and earth. And it was man's recognition of this pattern that was the fabric that was sewed, so that man's being was the beneficiary of the interface of heaven and earth. Thus, nature had a secret. It had a mysterious secret. Its secret was us. In our capability, we take heaven and earth, which in a mysterious originality were something closer than oneness, something more primordial than the one. But that when existence comes into being, one and zero interpenetrate in such a way that an interface of horizon is possible, and that is where we occur. That is where we are born. That is where we have our existence. And so man is the ratio of the real. This is the ancient way of talking. Man is the ratio of the real. We, in our objectivity, in our human-heartedness, in our gen, we transform Tao Te into heaven, earth, into Tian Ti. So that every, using the Chinese now for a moment, every Chinese emperor from the time of the unifying of China together as China, that is to say at the beginning of the Han Dynasty, about 223 BC, the great emperor who unified China took as the last word in his title, Ti. Qin Shi Huang Ti. And out of this comes the word China. Out of this comes the word Chinese. Ever after, the king was always some name ending with Ti, and Ti became the word which meant king, which meant emperor. So that one of the greatest rulers of the Han Dynasty, his name was Han Wu Ti. The name of the dynasty first, his energy place in that dynasty second, and Ti, meaning that he had the power to make it existent on earth. The Han Dynasty, through me, is existent on earth. Han Wu Ti. So the name of the emperor was the symbolic key that locked into place his authority, his power, his ability to ratio the real for his people. Now, all ancient wisdom traditions worked in exactly this way. The Egyptian pharaoh was not just somebody. He was exactly that emperor who locked heaven and earth together in a horizon which was able to keep the real effective in existence. Otherwise, life would not be able to continue at all. One is reminded of the poetic film Black Orpheus, made about 1959, set in the slums of Rio de Janeiro, the Orphic myth. All black actors in the slums of Rio de Janeiro, and when the Orpheus of his day dies, because Orpheus must die, the new Orpheus, who is the young black boy who takes his guitar, the guitar that has inscribed on it, "Orpheus is my master." The other little black children, a black girl and a black boy, urge him to quickly play, otherwise the sun will not rise. For if the magic language of ratioing the real is not uttered, the sun will not rise. Heaven will not penetrate from underneath the horizon of the earth and rise into the transcendence of heaven. Heaven will remain dead, buried under the earth's horizon. And so in Black Orpheus, furiously, the little black boy begins playing, and he plays the same song that he has heard his older friend play when he was alive. And immediately the little black girl begins dancing. She's about 6 years old, and begins dancing with the other little black boy who's about seven. And in the movement of their feet, in the resonance of the guitar, the director, Jules Dassin, shows the sun rising exactly where the horizon of the dance takes place. It is exactly here on this horizon that ratioing the real happens. Now, what is the understanding? As they say in the commercial world, what's the payoff of this? The payoff is that in a nature where we exist, we must participate in the ecology of that existence, or the ecology will not continue to occur. The fact that we are here means we have a place. We have a function to fulfill. If we do not fulfill that function, the lack of fulfilling that function will stop the flow of nature. And when some dynamic is stopped, that's where you get a pressure buildup. What is it that is before us in the ecology of nature? Before us is the unity of existence. And so to the extent that man does not cooperate with nature, to that extent, existence becomes a pressure against him. Nothing personal, but purely cosmic. And it is this cosmic pressure, then, against recalcitrant man that begins to bend all of the processes of flow into the demons. Goya, in one of his great lithographs, entitled it, translated into English, "The Sleep of Reason Produces Monsters." The anesthetizing of our sensitivity to participating in nature is what turns nature against us. And that anti, that disunity, that is a disease. And disease comes out of the blocking of the flow. So that, for instance, all of Chinese medicine is based upon the flow along meridians, and that there are pressure points, which are really focuses, energy focuses along those meridians. And that the health of someone is that one's body, with all the meridians, flows in a consonance, in a harmonic. You are ill because some meridian or other, at some point or other, is blocked. And the medicine is to unblock, to free, to return the flow. If you look at the human body, even with an electron microscope, you will find no meridians. You will find no points. Because they are not there statically. They are there resonantly. The meridians are a resonance of movement and not a static line. There's nowhere, even on atomic level, that there's any flow, thing, like a meridian. Yet it occurs and acts as if it were exactly there. Iron-bound lines. Because the resonances are real and not the things. So that Chinese medicine is based upon the movement of Tao, just like the I Ching. And one finds in Chinese medicine that the ancient medicine was always delivered with music. And the Chinese music was always pentatonic, a five-note scale. So that the ancient Chinese lute, the pipa, was tuned to the pentatonic scale. And when one would apply an acupuncture to various points, focuses on various meridians, it was always done musically with a harmonic. Because one had to keep in perfect balance the tuning, not of this meridian to this body, but the interfacing of this occurrence with the real. So that the scale is enormous at all times. Let's sum up here and then we'll take a break. Let's come back and understand, because we've come very far, very fast. and we're ready to understand something peculiar about nature. We began today by understanding that nature is always a cycle, that it's the dynamis of the cycle that cooperates with the resonant energy, absorption and emission, that the energy resonantly of a dynamic is what occurs as existence. The two components of this, if one wishes to put this into the electronic age, the two components of this are electromagnetic. That the magnetic is always the resonance quality, is always the real basis of energy. And the dynamic is always the electric. So that electromagnetic, the electromagnetic spectrum is a spectrum which carries the energy dynamic of existence, and that matter is but a form of this at a certain phase. And when one reaches certain critical horizon, matter will dissolve back into its primordial energy stratum and be harmonized instantly in the spectrum of electromagnetic cosmos. This is always the case. So that things are never real. Things never exist. Things are always provisional focuses which are malleable by the tuning of energy and dynamic together. So that nature is always a cycle of energy and dynamic, and that this cycle is an ecology of phases, and that the movement between phases is keyed by an equilibrium which allows for an exchange to occur. When we come back from the break, we'll talk about the exchange. It is through the secret of exchange of selves that love occurs. In the 8th century, that is in the 700s, the late 700s in India, one of the greatest intellects of all time lived. His name was Shantideva. He was a great Buddhist poet seer, and he wrote several books. The most famous was called the Bodhicaryavatara, Guarding the Thought of Enlightenment, which was the key towards progressing in wisdom. And in the 8th section of the Bodhicaryavatara, Shantideva initiated a whole new movement, a whole new phase in Eastern wisdom. He wrote, and in translation, it's translated as, the Bodhisattva guarantees the mystery of Dharma by participating in the secret exchange of selves. And out of this came a whole new movement in Eastern wisdom. Out of this late mature Mahayana came the Vajrayana, the diamond path. And at the very same time as Shantideva was living in India, one of the great meditators who heard Shantideva took this particular fresh insight for the first time across the Himalayas into Tibet, and his name was Padmasambhava. And Padmasambhava did not go alone. Meditators from the Buddha to Padmasambhava always went alone. But Padmasambhava went with a companion, a woman. Her name was Yeshe Tsogong. And it was the first male-female pair of wisdom teachers. And so the Vajrayana was born out of an exchange of selves, wisdom. Now, this is extremely peculiar and very paradoxical, because the very essence of Buddhism was no self, the selfless person. There is no self there. And so one is faced with a mysterious paradox. If neither had a self, what was it that they exchanged? And this, of course, is the mystery of the Diamond Path. Behind me is a scroll which the Chinese made about the time that Padmasambhava and Shantideva were giving out this initial teaching. The form of this background is a head with two eyes and a cranium and the long ears of a meditator. And where the mouth is a single figure who faces in. All the other figures face out. That single figure who faces in at the mouth of the cosmic Buddha, that figure is the only one who is existent. All the others are real. And it's only that meditator sitting in existence who harmonizes all of the primordiality, all of those figures who are real, but deeper than existence, into a pattern, into an ecology. That single meditator can bring everyone into play at the same time. This was the understanding of cosmos, East and West. For the idea of the Vajrayana was not an Eastern idea, but was born out of contact with primordially with Hellenistic Judaism. It's a Hellenistic Jewish idea. The origins of which are in the book called The Wisdom of Solomon that used to be in the Bible and were thrown out by Christian and Jewish councils both. The Council of Jamnia in 90 AD threw it out of the remembrance of the Jewish tradition and made it a forbidden book for a while. And the Christian councils of the late 300s, early 400s threw it out. Nevertheless, it is still the origin which some 800 years later became the cue in the Eastern tradition for developing the Vajrayana. The essential quality of it is the secret exchange of selves, even though there are no selves there to exchange. We'll come back after the break and look at nature some more. We need to bring into play at this particular juncture a symbol. And I want to bring into play the Eastern and the Western versions at the same time. The Eastern symbol that's frequently used, I think, in our time and to great advantage is the Tai Chi symbol. The circle with the two dots of black and white, the white circle in the middle of the black tear-shaped movement, and the opposite and the opposite. And also, that same symbol occurs in the West as the infinity sign. And very often this infinity sign is a cross-section of the intertwining of two serpents. And physiologically, this is also a cross-section of the neural energy of the spinal column. And if one does a yoga, Kundalini rises through one of the apertures and descends through the other. So that you have in the human physiology a formal structure which is literally exists in order to deliver the harmonic of the way in which nature occurs. to deliver the dynamic continuity and the energized resonance through the neural system to the body, so that the body is literally dynamic and energized because of the brain and its attendant spinal column and the neural system. One can go into many parallels, and this is just one graphic, rather large example, of the way in which these forms, physiology of molecular and atomic energy, of the way in which all matter is formed, and our education also has this structure, also has this form. We're now at the second half of the fourth lecture. We're coming to a closure of the first month, and this is also a closure of the first third of the first of 8 seasons in our education. We have 2 years, and each of the 2 years has 4 parts or 4 seasons, and we're coming to the juncture where the first third of the first of 4 of the first year. So there are ways now that one could make a geometric tapping of relationality. For instance, the fourth lecture of the Nature series will have a relationship with the fourth lecture of the Vision series next year. It will also have a relationship in parallel with the fourth lecture of every one of the 8 sequences. The relationship with the fourth lecture of the Vision will be a direct relationality, only instead of this one being integral, that one will be differential. And we'll see when we come next year to Vision, the 2 texts that we will use in Vision will be the basic text from the Renaissance, Pico della Mirandola's On the Dignity of Man, the most formative oration of the Italian Renaissance, and the Poemander, an ancient Hermetic treatise from Alexandria, roughly around 90 AD, written at just the same time as the Council of Jamnia, exiled from Judaism, any of the Hellenistic cosmic developments, so that one was left with a Torah, the text of which at that time was called the Masoretic text. It is exactly the text that one would buy today if you bought, if you went to a Jewish bookstore. The text that you would buy of the Bible would be exactly the same. Not one punctuation mark has changed since 90 AD. The Christianity of 90 AD was not so well advanced at that time, and was characterized rather by the last book of the New Testament, the Book of Revelation, which was written about that time. Politically in the world, what was happening was the Roman Empire was suffering the terror of the mad reign of Domitian, the eldest son of Vespasian, who considered himself the Messiah of the New Age. And after he died and his younger son Titus passed away, Domitian came in to rule, and he ruled with a terrific terror campaign. He was unable to put a certain individual to death for metaphysical fear. That individual is known to us as Saint John. And so Saint John was exiled to an archetypal prison that Domitian thought was going to ground his magic. He was exiled to the island of Patmos off the coast of modern-day Turkey. Patmos is a rocky island, not too far off from Rhodes or from the Turkish mainland, but it's in the shape of a ship. And Patmos looks like a ship frozen in stone in the middle of the Aegean Sea. And archetypally to Domitian, it was the perfect exile for the only man whose language he feared the magic of. That was St. John. And it was there on that stone ship of Patmos that St. John wrote the book that we know as Revelation. He actually took an apocalypse by John the Baptist and enfolded at the front and at the rear, at the beginning and at the end, his own magical writing. So that the book of Revelation is actually the apocalypse of John the Baptist enfolded by a apocalypse of St. John. And so it's a double apocalypse. So the book of Revelation has a structure very curious indeed. What has all this to do with our education? Simply that we might as well get educated about the tremendous scope that we are involved in, because our lives are still structured by all of these occurrences. And next year in Vision, when we use On the Dignity of Man by Pico della Mirandola, which spurs the Italian Renaissance at a time when it was at its apex. You had people like Ficino and Leonardo and Michelangelo and Botticelli, and I'm sure you've heard of them. They made a poignant breakthrough exactly at the time when the world made a breakthrough to another level. The year was 1492, and I think that you understand that the same year that Columbus discovered America, opening the New World, Ficino published his translation of Plotinus, and the Muslims were expelled from Spain, all in the same year, and Pico's Oration on the Dignity of Man brought back into play an ancient wisdom that was codified by the Poimandres in 90 AD. And so the 1400 years in between the Poimandres and On the Dignity of Man, they are parallel resonances of the same symbol operative. And when we get to Vision next year, we'll be able to talk this way. Right now, it's premature to talk this way. Right now, we're at the culmination of the first month of nature. And though we'll be able to understand symbols and ideas of great power, great structuring capacity, what we're trying to do right now is to sensitize ourselves to nature. And nature has a very noticeable, appreciable set of qualities. This set of qualities can also be called a matrix. A matrix is a mathematical term for a set. The qualities could be said independently, but if said independently, they are so iridescent that they tend to be, the word is evanescent. They tend to evaporate. They tend not to be memorable. One can appreciate them in the flash of an insight, but the insight goes very quickly. So in order to preserve insights like this and not lose them, there is a memory form called a matrix. And a matrix arranges into a specific ordering the elements out of which it is made. Now, the most simple matrix is a two-dimensional matrix, which has all of the A's arranged on one line and all of the B's on another line, so that you get intersecting columns and boxes that show the various kinds of ways in which A's and B's come together, so that a matrix is a permutation tablet that keeps track of all the variants that are possible for the given number of elements. Our initial matrix for nature is a matrix of change that has only two columns. One is dynamic and the other is energy. So that in a matrix of dynamic energy or electromagnetism, one can characterize initially, though it can be improved and will be improved much later. For now, all we have to do is appreciate this. And that the basis, the material out of which the tablet is made, that records the dynamic and the energy, the tablet itself is us. We are the tablet. Without us, the matrix does not occur in existence. So when we say, as they said in the Renaissance, echoing what was the wisdom in ancient times that was remembered and made it a Renaissance, man is the measurer of all things. Now, this particular Hermetic adage or saying, man is the measurer of all things, was a pun at the time. It was a pun upon an adage that was out of date 500 years before, and the adage 500 years before was that man was the measure of all things, an adage which one of the most handsome sophists in Athens used to declare. His name was Protagoras, and Plato has a dialogue entitled Protagoras, which is all about the way in which Protagoras and Socrates had a crunch one day. Protagoras with all the beautiful young men who were very clever and very smart and very rich, and Socrates, who wasn't very handsome, who was very poor, and who seemed to be very clumsy. And Plato's Protagoras is a record of the way in which Socrates penetrates so precisely through the error that man is not the measure of all things, but man is the measurer of all things, which is totally different. In the Renaissance, when Pico writes his oration on the dignity of man, he says, when the whole spectrum of creation was made, and all of the array of possibilities were given their stable levels at which they exist, God took the essence out of each one of the levels and put those together and made man. So that man is the measurer of all things because he has universal mobility and can go on every level of existence in the cosmos and be real. This is how you make a Renaissance. This is how you discontinue a medieval, feudal prison system of man's courage and capacity. And that you bring his character back into scintillating mobility and free him for action. This is the whole essence of what it is to be educated. Now, we're talking about nature. We'll talk about vision next year. Same time next year. What we're talking about now is how nature is a cycle. And nature's cycle has a flow, and that flow has phases. It has a form to its phases, so that we could say that nature is a phased form flow. Nature is a stream that has definite waterfalls along its way to the ocean. And this movement of this waterfall, phased form movement to the ocean, this quality is what appears in Moby Dick right away, because as soon as we're introduced to Ishmael, he's wandering in the countryside along a stream that's flowing, and he realizes some deep intuition, a universal truth, that all streams flow to the ocean, and that his destiny is there in that ocean, and that the ocean is characterized by the largest of all living things, the whale, and that of all the whales, the most brutally sentient of all is Moby Dick, and that he will discover. If nature can be characterized as a phased form cycle of flow, of energy and dynamic, how many phases are there in nature? In China, there were said to be 5. In Egypt, there were said to be 8. In the Chinese, there is a musical scale that has 5 notes, the pentatonic scale. In the West, our musical scale has 8 notes. There is an ogdode, there is an octet, there is an eightfold quality. So that one has in Egypt, in Iran, in India, in Greece, in Judaism, in Christianity, one has a penchant for an eightfold quality, an eightfold wholeness. In the ancient Jewish tradition, always there was a reluctance to have man complete God's place, and so one was withheld, and one could only say 7, and the 8th was left for God to fill in. Whereas in the Egyptian, there was always the 8 was the fullness, but there was a mysterious 9th which man could never fill in. So that in the, for instance, in the Nag Hammadi manuscripts that were discovered in Egypt that had been buried about 365 AD because it was death to have such books. It was a Christian edict by Cyril of Alexandria. If you own these books, you will be killed. So they were buried alongside the Nile River. And they were found in 1945. And out of these books, notice they're not scrolls, but they're codexes, books. It means that they belong to a differential form of historical consciousness and not to an amulet integral form like the scrolls. One of the treatises in the Nag Hammadi books is the Hermetic treatise of the 8th reveals the 9th. That one can come to a fullness of wisdom with an 8, with an infinity turned 90 degrees, that a Pythagorean right angle relationship of infinity and 8 occurs, and that one must be able to stand up in order to position one's human fullness into a cosmic harmonic receiver. One finds this, for instance, in Thoreau, where he is talking, he was writing about the way in which we must not allow ourselves to be conditioned by the prone position of just taking the world as it is handed to us, but we must be able to stand on our own and move from that stance, from that individual presence of our own, move under our own steam, create the dynamic and the energy of our own person by taking a walk. And if you have read through some of the readings on Thoreau, you will have run across this. This ability to take a walk in your own person, in the world, in your own way, is one of the litmus tests of maturity. Something so simple as that is a way of testing the psychic weather. If you cannot take a walk on your own in the world, then you are indeed baffled by illusion. So that one of the very earliest and easiest of all diagnostics is to watch how someone walks. In fact, Pythagoras used to admit people into the community by watching them walk before him. You can, in time, with maturity and insight, read everything there is to read about someone by the way they walk. You can diagnose yourself by your ability to walk freely or not. And nature has this kind of quality to it. When nature flows freely, it's like nature taking a walk. One of the timeless images of paradise is that paradise is a place where God takes a walk in the early morning. This quality of nature is based upon an interface of equanimity occurring within the cycle, within the phase form flow, that there is an equanimity which does not interrupt the flow. A horizon which does not interrupt the flow participates in that flow. And so in the I Ching, in the way in which the hexagrams are structured, we find a cue for ourselves, the most ancient written symbolic cue of this mystery of nature. It's about 3,700 years before Shantideva. Here's how the Chinese that founded the Zhou dynasty about the time of the Trojan War understood it. They received from a 2,000-year-old tradition the I Ching in terms of the trigrams and the hexagrams. They used the same trigrams and hexagrams, but in a new way. They called, at that time, the new way the inner world arrangement, Chinese words that translate to human-based measurer, man the measurer arrangement, and that this was somewhat different from the former heavenly arrangement, that the old ancient arrangement was based upon a heavenly pattern, and the new arrangement was based upon man's pattern. Not man as distinct from heaven, but man in his place functioning with heaven. So that heavenly man was now recognizing his place and was consciously able to adjust the use of the I Ching in this new way. In a way, the Zhou dynasty is a renaissance of ancient China. The formerly heaven arrangement took the movement of the unbroken line and the broken line, took their movements through a process where, in order to give us a broken line, we have to surround it with a form that allows that broken line to be seen. You cannot just draw the line. So the trigrams are born out of a broken line, and above it an unbroken line, and above it two broken lines. So, and I'll use the term yin and yang here because you're more familiar with that, though be aware that they're somewhat misleading. The yang line occurs at the bottom with two yin lines above it. This is the beginning of the male quality in nature, whereas the beginning of the female quality in nature is the discontinuity with two unbroken lines above it, the yin line with the two yang lines above it. So one always builds up. So in the trigrams, in the three lines, the bottom line on one is unbroken, yang. The bottom line on the other is broken, or yin. In the matrix of possibilities, this unbroken line and this broken line can occur in each of one, two, three places. So that's the dynamic movement of that line. Let's put it in sexual terms for a moment because it's more convenient to hear. The male power can occupy three energy levels, and the female power can occupy three energy levels. When you symbolically inscribe those energy levels, they're by the position of the broken or unbroken line in the three parts of a trigram, the three levels of a trigram. So if the broken line for the yin can be on the bottom, in the middle, and on the top. The same too for the yang line, it can be on the bottom, on the middle, and on the top. In the yang progression, when it's on the bottom, its natural image is said to be thunder. And when it's in the middle, its natural image is said to be water. And when it's at the top, its natural image is said to be a mountain. And when you abstract the yang line out of all three of these trigrams and put the abstraction together as a perfected yang, all three lines unbroken, that's the image of heaven. That's the image of the creative. So the male dynamic rises through four energy levels, three on earth and one in heaven. And its rising is from thunder to water to mountain to heaven. And the ancient way of saying this is like a rainstorm coming. You're the thunder, then comes the rain, and the rain collects on the mountain, and the mountain, you notice, is against the heavens. So the male line, the yang line, the creative dynamic has this movement. Thunder, water, mountain, and then heaven. The female movement, the receptive movement, is a complement to this and ends up with the three broken lines, the three discontinuous lines, abstracted, and that's the image of Earth. At the beginning of the female movement is Sun, the gentle, and the image for that was always wind. And sometimes later, in the five element school, they introduced wood. So that the female movement is the gentle wind. It begins with the gentle wind. And you can also have the corollary wood. You can think of a wind moving in the forest. That the female energy begins like the wind in the forest. And at the middle, its energy is said to be fire, that the wind intensifies as fire. And so that the energy focus of the female is fire, whereas the energy focus of the male is water. And the female has its third movement at the top of the trigram. The image of that was Tui, which is the lake. Now, why would fire, the wind, and the fire collect into the lake? And the lake then is set in the earth. is extreme mystery until one understands that this designation of lake came in the Zhou dynasty, not in ancient times. If one looks at the Zhou Guang, at the commentary that one of the commentaries that Confucius gave here, he writes here about the lake. The joyous is the lake. It is also a sorceress. The mouth and tongue, it means smashing, breaking apart. It means dropping off and bursting open. Among the kinds of soil, it is the hard and salty. It is the concubine. The sorceress is the kind of woman who is able to speak. To speak what? To speak magic language. The trigram is open above. That is to say, it has two yang lines, then a yin line on the top. The image of the mouth speaking. Connected with the idea of autumn, with destruction, smashing, breaking apart. How, the time of ripe fruits, how does one get lake out of this? The apex of the movement is from 1, 2, 3, so that the second movement of both is in the middle. The second movement of the male is water. The second movement of the female is fire. Now, when you pair these together, fire and water are the two universal solvents. For instance, in ancient times, all alchemy worked because fire and water were solvents that were brought mutually to bear. The whole word solvent, out of which comes the mathematical word solution, out of which comes the biochemical term solution. The whole way to dissolve is through water or through fire. Now later on, after a lot of experience, one finds that there's a third solvent. Other than water and fire, one finds that there's an energized water called alcohol, which is also a universal solvent, a third great solvent. And so when one is working in a trismegistically way, the alchemical solvents are water, alcohol, and fire. But that's for a later age. At this particular level, at the beginning of the Zhou dynasty, about the Trojan War, about 1100 BC, fire and water were the universal solvents that were known and understood. The movement of the two trigram columns was seen to have equipoise at the middle, and thus the middle of the male movement was able to exchange itself with the middle of the female movement. That is to say, the natural progression of male and female energies at their mutual middles were able to exchange essences. So that now water worked as the exchange middle of the female progression, and fire worked as the exchange position of the middle of the male progression. This is why in the Chinese symbol, the Tai Chi, one has a circle of dark in the light and a circle of light in the dark. The dark circle is the sun energy working in the female energy cycle, and the light circle is the way in which the center of the male works in, the female works in the male. So that now one has an exchange of solvents between the male and female dynamic. The male solvent, the male solution key, is hidden in the middle of the female energy cycle. And conversely, the essence of the female dynamic is hidden in the energy levels of the male. So that now one says that there's a secret masculine essence in the female energy. And there's a secret essence in the male energy, which is female. Now we know today in the psychotherapy of the 20th century, because of the Greek language predilection of the early German developers of the psychoanalytic technique, Freud and Jung and Adler and so forth, that the female soul in the male is called the anima. Man's soul is female. And the male soul in the female is called the animus, is male. So the essence of the female at an energy equilibrium is a masculine energy, the energy of water. And at the essence of the male is a female energy, the essence of fire. So that the Zhou Dynasty I Ching, the I Ching in the Zhou Dynasty, stopped using the pure separated masculine and feminine energy cycles that were paired by intertwining, and they started using an intertwining that at the equilibrium point they exchanged. So that one had a double quality to the movement of energy and dynamic. Nature acquired another dimension and added to its complexity. It now had the energy of cross-fertilization, of interfaces where there was an exchange that happened. And the record of the Zhou Dynasty is most beautifully preserved in the most ancient book of Chinese poetry. Notice that before the Zhou Dynasty, there never was a book of poetry in China. Now, for the first time, you have the Book of Songs. And the Book of Songs in China reads just like the Song of Songs in the Old Testament. It's a joyous celebrating of the splendor of the way in which man has discovered a new light within himself, the light of cross-fertilization, the light where his energy dynamic interpenetrates in such a way that there's an exchange quality, there's an alchemy now, not only within the columns of parallel energies, but the parallel energies now have an exchange, and that exchange is always on levels where equanimity occurs. Wherever there's an equilibrium, life processes will flow freely and in such a way that they operate in each other's court sufficiently. It's rather like the discovery that in our blood system, in the cardiovascular system of the body, if you inject fresh water into the blood system, it will kill you. If you inject salt water, seawater, into the blood system, it will temporarily function as blood. Because blood is the same kind of briny solution that seawater is. Whereas fresh water is distilled for use internally and not in a digestive tract rather than in a cardiovascular tract. In an odd way, the Zhou Dynasty discovered that though they had a new dimension of nature to understand, if the old wisdom was now used, it would always be dependable to work, but the new wisdom would work much better, but that you had to be careful about using it, because if you tried to put the new wisdom into an old form, it would poison it, it would kill it. One of the alchemical adages of Jesus, don't put new wine into old skins. It will burst them. So that there was an extra added quality to the I Ching in the Zhou Dynasty. That's why the I Ching, the alternate name for I Ching now, when you look at the Chinese characters, it doesn't read just I Ching. It doesn't in fact say I Ching. It says Zhou Yi, the book of Zhou. Because the emphasis is no longer just on change. Yes, change is the essence of nature, but now it's the kind of changes that the Zhou dynasty was founded on and remembered. And the Book of Songs is the great Confucian classic, the first collection of Chinese poetry, and what it celebrates is that man's horizon now is as real as heaven and earth because of an interface, an exchange, because man in his equilibrium brings the nature of heaven and the nature of earth into play in each other. And the very earliest archaic form of heaven on earth was to see heaven reflected in a body of limited water, like a lake. One of the most profound of all the Paleolithic sites in southern England is Avebury. Most people talk about Stonehenge and so forth, but Avebury, extremely much older. And just south of Avebury is Silbury Hill. And Silbury Hill was a mound, and it had an ancient trench around it, and it forever eluded antiquarians of why it was there. Why was there just this mound with this trench around it? And about 20 years ago, a man named Michael Demes was meditating on the top of Silbury Hill in a rainstorm, and he noticed that the water collected around the mound in this trench and formed a temporary artificial moat, a lake around it. And when the storm cleared, he saw that the pattern of the stars was now reflected in this ring around the hill, the mound. And coming down from Silbury Hill and looking at it in profile, he saw it was in the shape of a human breast. The ring of the stars around a breast was the perfect exchange of heaven and earth together because of man's recognition of his equilibrium bringing them together. So that Silbury Hill is the esoteric key to the old Paleolithic Avebury in just this way that the Zhou people 3,000 years ago understood. When man participates with nature, his existence locks in as a key and brings zero and one together as a pair. And forever, Tao, Te, then are paired in him. Man is the measurer of all things because he has the caliper of existence in the real linked together. And with this, he can measure all things. He's not the measure, but he's the measurer. He's the tool bearer who holds the equilibrium in its paired form and can apply it. And wherever he applies it, it is so. Why is it so? Because he is real and his existence has that basis upon which to apply. The very horizon that comes into being then is called mind. The very space where symbols occur is where the horizon of man's experienced speech makes forms out of the ritual existence basis on which he does, and nature allows for this all to occur. Next week, we go to galaxies and to the particle explosion to look at the very small and the very large. And we want to make a vertical line between the atomic and the cosmic worlds to see that the horizon of man, the measurer, also ratios the atomic and cosmic together in such a way that they exchange middles also. Thank you.